What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are a progressive politics show broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And for today's show, we are speaking truth to power about the Transgender Day of Remembrance, Amazon, or as I like to call it, Scamazon, and our ex-Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness. We will begin this show and every show until there is justice for Indigenous people talking about colonialism. So, on today, the Transgender Day of Remembrance, we are remembering the lives lost due to our capitalist colonial system's inherent sexism, heteronormativity, and violent enforcement of the status quo. However, there's a long history of Indigenous peoples being open to gender fluidity, and this term is called Two-Spirit. So, Two-Spirit is a Ojibwe term, and it refers to a person who embodies both a masculine and feminine spirit. Activist Albert MacLeod developed the term in 1990 to broadly reference Indigenous peoples in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. Two-spirit is used by some Indigenous peoples to describe their gender, sexual, and spiritual identity. Different Indigenous cultures have their own variations of the term Two-Spirit, but all of these terms have historically been used to describe similar traits embodied by Two-Spirit people, including gender variance, specialized work roles, same-sex attraction, and spiritual identity. Two-Spirit commonly referred to gender identity, dress, and traditional roles. The Cree terms respectively reference men who dress like women and women who dress like men. The Blackfoot describe men who performed roles typically associated with women, such as basket weaving and pottery making. And Kootenai people use Two-Spirit to describe females who took on roles traditionally characterized as masculine, including healing, hunting, and warfare. One of the most well-known Two-Spirit people who identified as females was Wei Hua, 1846-96, of New Mexico. She was referred to as Ihaman, or mixed gender, in the Zuni language. In various Indigenous cultures, temperament, work roles, dress, and lifestyle distinguish Two-Spirited individuals from men and women. In some cases, the term referred specifically to sexualities, such as the Mi'kmaq phrase Ginumu Gesalagi, which means he loves men. However, Two-Spirit people did not necessarily see themselves as homosexual. Sexual relationships between a Two-Spirit and a non-Two-Spirit were considered heteronormative. While European colonists considered Two-Spirit people homosexual, and while the modern usage of the term can describe homosexuals, historically, Two-Spirit people did not so easily identify as either homosexual or heterosexual. Two-Spirit also referred to spiritual identity. In many Indigenous communities, Two-Spirited individuals were believed to have received supernatural intervention in the form of dreams and visions. As such, they often filled special spiritual roles in their communities as healers, shamans, and ceremonial leaders. Historically, Two-Spirit people were also great sources of knowledge. They are keepers of tradition and tellers of creation stories. Two-Spirit was a complex role and identity that modern-day Two-Spirited individuals can use to reclaim traditions related to gender identity, sexual preference, spiritual identity, and traditional roles. So that's a quick rundown of Two-Spirit and what that means and the history behind it, as well as the different Indigenous cultures and how they interacted with the idea. And to me, this idea kind of strikes me as Indigenous communities not really needing to enforce a gender binary nor any heteronormativity or a certain sexuality. There was no need to tell people like how to behave, how to act, how to perform, which I think is going to be a big topic, especially as we cover transgender and performativity. And what I mean by those things is that it can be observed that a lot of the things that people take as like biologically inherent to one another is really just them acting the role that they were taught. You know, when you give a kid trucks to play with as a child, they will then exhibit more masculine quote-unquote traits versus someone that is given dolls and they are forced into femininity almost, and they're conditioned to think that way. And likewise with heteronormativity in all our media basically, right. And all of our cultures. So I really like what's going on with this, what Indigenous people talk about when they say Two-Spirit, because in my opinion it's pretty, like, I don't really care. I mean, like, I can't believe other people care, to be completely honest with you. So the fact that they kind of, you know, were ahead of the game, so to speak, about this whole gender fluidity thing is really speaks a lot to the really, I think it's a really big Western thing that, like, as the future goes on, we socially progress because of technology as well, which I don't think is necessarily true at all. Because these people, you know, I'm not saying, you know, they didn't necessarily have running water or electricity, but, like, you know, they didn't violently, you know, murder people that were transgender.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm going to focus, however, on the intersection between, you know, our capitalist system and enforcing the gender binary and, like, locking people up in asylums for a long time, criminalizing people for, you know, deviant, quote unquote, deviant behavior. Right. And as well as people on the street, like reactionaries that see transgender people or think about transgender people and get upset or angry and then murder them. Because that's why we have the Transgender Day of Remembrance. And we'll get back to that topic broadly. But what do you think about this whole two-spirit thing, as well as the comparing and contrasting it to our current heteronormative society?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the idea that these cultures who, you know, we, some certain ignorant people might say were more primitive, and they certainly were in a technological sense, their ideas were just as progressive as we find, you know, very intellectual-minded spaces today, right? You know, they recognize the nuances, the deep nuances which exist within human psychology, and the fact that you can't, we are as complex as our mind works, right? And you go through a plethora of emotions within a single day, so within a lifetime. And it's funny, these people were within, yes, they had a routine and they had to survive, but in a certain way, they were more free, right? Free from what we today would call labor, capital, right? Just being regimented to the nth degree, right?
And having their, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, you know, because, like, in their societies, work was separate from labor, because labor is when you sell your labor power, your ability to do work to a capitalist so that they can extract the value from your labor. So, for example, say that they pay you $20 an hour, for example, and then, you know, in your first 3 hours of work, you produce, you know, the $160 right. worth of stuff that they're paying you to make, but the rest of that time on top is just money in their pocket that you're producing. So say if you're at the in 3 hours you can do your whole wages worth of productivity, the rest of that on top of that is just money in the capitalist pocket. And that's not how they organized, you know, indigenous communities. It was a communist system, more or less, where all the needs were met and then that was it.
Right.
You didn't need to go beyond that. You didn't need to create stuff for the sake of creating. You didn't create commodities for the sake of creating commodities. You know, if there was a canoe that needed to be built, they're building the canoe.
Right.
You know, if there was food that needed to be put on tables, the food was going to be on the tables.
And would meet a purpose.
Yeah. And then also I think about that too in their economic system, because they also didn't need, they could use everyone's, regardless of their gender role, sexual identity or anything. It could, you know, you were just, you could do what you could do and that was it. And not to make this too much about, you know, class and economics, but I just like to compare and contrast the two, because it's interesting to see how our system makes things worse for people when in reality, and I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to go back to a time without electricity or running water, but it's just a time where you could see how, like, you don't need to organize. That's all it is. I'm talking about the organization of this, and just how, you know, when you don't need to exploit your workforce, you don't need to violently because you need to violently enforce the exploitation of the worker. Now you don't need to violently enforce anything else.
Right.
You know, you don't need any oppression regardless of your gender or sexual identity.
Right. And I think businesses like to avoid complexity and uncertainty. And that's something which the human mind is natural about. And it's funny, the whole point you're trying to make, how, you know, consumerism imposes these this gender binary process on us, right? And, you know, it's for their own benefit, clearly, because it's easier to sell pink to girls and blue or whatever to guys, right?
Yeah, and then if you don't fit either or, and you don't, you know, you're not going to be, and especially, well, let's get into just, you know, I know we're not experts in gender theory or identity or sexual identity theory or anything of the like, but I can tell you this much. If you don't violently enforce women, young you know, young children to be girls and be attracted to the more expensive shampoo when it's the same as the male shampoo,
right.
The more expensive deodorant. I know these are like minor things, but I'm just showing you how that, like, just the basic stuff and how everything is gendered in our world, and that serves a purpose. It's not just accidental, you know, like you can have one class of people, and then even worse when it comes to women, then they're relegated to the household to do free domestic labor for the man while the man goes off and sells their labor and be exploited by the capitalists. So
absolutely.
You see, it's divisions in the working class, but also that you see how like transgender people don't fit into this.
Right.
You know, they're not going to have clear roles of who's going to work and who's going to do unpaid domestic labor and be basically a slave, right, as women are. So, and then we get into homosexuality, and homosexuality is all over the place for these people because they, you know, and their reactionary mind just gets going and they can't, you know, pin these people down into neat little boxes. And just the fact that we even need boxes for human beings, because I think human beings are infinitely complex. You know, they have how many things affect them to get to this point in their lives.
Absolutely.
And you need to like put a label on them.
Right.
And that's, and you know, and the, while we're on the Trans Day of Remembrance, you know, the left is, you know, there's obviously reactionary parts of the left that, you know, view this as bourgeois decadence. But, you know, we personally in the 21st century and the vast majority of 99% of leftists do not see it as such. They just see it as people who are trying to express themselves freely, find themselves in the capitalist system, which is the antithesis of freedom. And now they're forced to be put into a box and have to act a certain way and sell their labor a certain way. So today, the Trans Day of Remembrance, this is an article from CBC by Claire Hennig. BC cities mark International Trans Day of Remembrance, some for the first time. Vancouver has held the annual event since 2002, and Prince George is hosting its first vigil. Hundreds of transgender people around the world are killed every year simply for being trans. British Columbians are marking their deaths in an annual day of remembrance. Some cities, like Prince Rupert, are officially recognizing November 20th as the Trans Day of Remembrance for the first time. Tammy Starlight, founder of the Vancouver Trans Day of Remembrance, emphasized that discrimination and violence are not just a problem abroad. Yeah, can you believe that? It's not just people out there in the United States or Russia or all these other places where all the bad things happen. Actually, it happens at home in BC as well. Our goal is to point out that what's been happening around the world globally and that it continues to happen locally, Starlight said. Ajit, what do you think about this? I always get really upset when people try to obfuscate the obvious, you know, similarities of the capitalist system, no matter where you are in the world, into it's over there, it's out there, right. not in our good maple washed perfect multicultural society. Right. How do you feel about that?
Oh yeah, I mean that's what ignorance is bliss, right? And like we love to think that, you know, we're good, right? And it's very interesting that multiculturalism in a kind of weird way, because a lot of immigrant communities hold on to very traditionalist conservative views, kind of allows for the continuation of a lot of this discrimination, inherent discrimination against trans people, because to them, holding on to a lot of those traditional beliefs, they, you know, this seems very strange to them, especially to the parents who are immigrants or whatnot. I can certainly state that from my own family. That
wait, Ajit, oppression exists other places?
Right.
Really?
And in different forms, too.
What? Wow, it's almost like this is a global system of oppression.
Right.
Weird.
I just want to say, just to, you know, call capitalists hypocrites, again, you know, you guys promote this hyper-individualism, so don't be hating on it now, because this is a byproduct.
They're being individuals.
Right.
And it's great. It's nice to see that.
Like, choice. Isn't freedom choice?
Yeah. Like, they're so free to choose. Wait, no, you're free to choose within the gender binary.
Exactly.
You're free to choose within this.
What we give you.
These two choices,
right.
You know, but you're free to choose one or the other. Actually, no, you're not.
Right.
Not even close.
You can have 50 different flavors of ice cream, though.
But if you're born with a penis, you're a boy.
Right.
And you're going to stay a boy. And you must act like a boy.
Yeah. And then if you're a celebrity who has a sex change, we're going to prod you all day long to know if you got rid of your...
Just
you got a genital replacement.
The most vulgar stuff that has nothing to do with anything. And like, you know, like Caitlyn Jenner takes up all the headlines, you know. But like, you know, let's talk about the actual victims of this. You know, let's talk about the people who lose their lives.
We, obviously like, got a lavish, the elite transgender person. I know,
it's person, like, oh my god. Like, trans people didn't exist before that? Like,
No.
People have been murdered.
Right.
Killed. And not because of, you know, a car crash.
No.
Not because of, shockingly, a U.S. Mass shooting, but because of their identity. And that just blows my mind. And it's sad. And like, people need to start thinking about that. And if you see trans people in the street, don't be scared. Don't be put off because they look different than you. Just understand that this is how our society treats people who are just different.
Right.
And it's like, you know, once again, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, a capitalist free market. Well, the free exchange of ideas and marketplace of whatever, more like the marketplace of bullshit. But these people, like, the second you just challenge anything that is, you know, entrenched in the capitalist system, such as a gender binary, such as heteronormativity, they just lose their minds.
Right.
You're free to choose, just not that.
Right.
Moving on in the article, Tammy Starlight started the first Vancouver version of the Remembrance Day in 2002. 16 years later, several policy changes have been introduced, like BC recently recognizing a gender X on official documents and improving access to gender-affirming surgery. But Starlight is still concerned about the direction of change. The trans community seems to only be voiced through professional institutions and governmental institutions, she said. The grassroots, streetwise trans community doesn't seem to have much of a voice. Thinking about that, I've noticed that as well. It's hard because, you know, you can see how like our elitist neoliberal society is all about the individual, and by we say the individual, we mean the rich individual and the powerful individual, and those are the people that get to change, you get to choose,
right?
And then you got to understand, like, oh, why is this one individual so powerful? Because of the collective power behind them, right? But then as soon as you create your own collective power on the streets, you create your own collective, you know, power in your movements, you're silenced and you're pushed away, and they don't want to hear from you, even though that these issues are affecting these people, which is why they got organized in the first place.
Right.
And they're completely shut out from even deciding their own fates. Very anti-democratic of them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Another conflation of liberal democracy and capitalism gone awry, because as soon as, you know, people demand democratic rights, they're pushed away.
Right.
Yeah. So the last bit of the article, change and acceptance has to come from the community level. Tammy Starlight emphasized, we can have these protectors and bathroom markers change and whatnot, but unless they are enforced and it becomes part of the active memory of the community, then they're just simply on paper, Starlight said. And I think that's such a beautiful way to sum this up, because a lot of liberals, think that because laws are passed that people will follow them. Let's talk about the structures that have remained completely unchanged. Let's talk about an economic system where your boss is an autocrat and can decide whatever they want for their workers because they own the means of production.
Mm-hmm.
That totally puts trans people at a disadvantage.
Like,
right. even in the workplace, they're not going to be treated the same as everyone else. Are you crazy? Like, look at how we just murder them.
Right.
There's no way they're getting treated the same.
Oh, and we live in a service-based economy, and, you know, a lot of services are based off your appearance or, you know, fitting a certain, whatever certain image your boss or company wants you to portray. So, you know, they can't be who they are, essentially.
Yeah, and that's really well
said. They can't be open about who they are.
Yeah, that's really well said, because you have to perform based on your company's expectation. You can't even be yourself.
No.
So how can, you know, like, the bathroom is great. It's great, the gender-neutral bathroom. I was in the gender-neutral bathroom at the old Sub the Life building. It's great. There's a toilet everywhere. Turns out that's fine. But until we get at the roots of this problem and the roots of, like, why we have a gender binary and why it's violently enforced, it's not going to change the violent. It's going to move the violent enforcement of the normativity, like the heteronormativity and the gender binary, from the state where it was historically done to the reactionary mob that has now taken over in its place.
Right.
And that's the way I see it, especially looking at like these white supremacist groups like the Proud Boys and stuff like that. They hate trans people. They are brutal in the words that they say towards these people. And they're going to be, you know, as long as Trump's in office, as long as Maxime Bernier is, you know, taking up all the headline space and all these horrible reactionaries are in charge, it's going to get worse. They're going to feel emboldened to act upon those like urges that they have.
Right.
Yeah. It's you know, we remember the hundreds lost this year, and you know, until we can deal with the roots of capitalism and the roots of heteronormativity and enforcement of a cisgender identity, then more people are going to die. And for that reason alone, I think that people need to start taking, you know, anti-capitalist action seriously. They need to start dealing with these things, because it's great that we're dealing with trans rights, but we got to get to the roots of these problems before more people lose their lives.
Absolutely.
You know, we're gonna have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that, so don't change that dial.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke you every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
British Columbia is in the middle of an electoral referendum. Throughout November, eligible voters will be asked to choose between the current system of first-past-the-post or one based on proportional representation.
But what is proportional representation? The name gives a lot away. These are systems that match the overall proportion of votes cast in the province to the proportion of elected MLAs. That is, a party that gets 30% of the votes gets 30% of the seats in the legislature.
To learn more about First Past the Post and the proportional representation systems, go to uvotebc.ca. If you haven't received your ballot, go to elections.bc.ca to find out how.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and I'm with my host, co-host Ajit.
What's up?
And we are going to be starting a new segment. We are going to find one of the... We're going to start with the most brutal capitalists and their horrible scams, grifts that they are running on the working class, but also the world. So these have environmental impacts as well as class impacts. And, you know, we'd like to keep our class identity at the forefront of our mind before we get tricked by the wolves in sheep's clothing, the liberal class, that tell us that privatization is good and that the trickle down will happen sometime soon. Well, we've been waiting for it since 1980. So I'm going to pass along to Ajit to name the first person we will be sending to the guillotine.
Right. You guys might be familiar with him. He's currently officially the most richest man in the world, and that is none other than Amazon founder, CEO, and new corporate overlord, Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos, everybody. Clap it up for Jeff. He's being sent to the guillotine, net worth of $137.6 billion as of November 2018.
Right. And what's been making recent headlines in the news has been this whole Amazon HQ2, which is headquarters 2, right? Their current headquarters is very close to us. It's in Seattle, just south of the border. But in the past few years, this massive explosion in online shopping and Amazon becoming the biggest retailer in the world, a retailer without even having a storefront, they've been looking to add a second headquarters, essentially. I don't know. And they made a giant contest out of it. And so the article I'm going to be talking about, it's called, "Was Amazon's Headquarters Search a Giant Ruse? NYC, DC, Centers of Power Prevail." It's by Nathan Bomey from USA Today, posted November 13th. And it reads, "As Amazon dangled the prospect of 50,000 jobs and economic transformation, virtually every major city in the country jockeyed to win an economic development race for the ages. But cities such as Chicago, Denver, Pittsburgh, Phoenix, Miami, and LA were ultimately left empty-handed. Did those cities get played? Did they ever have a legitimate shot at winning this race? Critics say Amazon exploited the list of contenders for the sake of learning more about their secret plans for infrastructure investments, economic development, and tax incentives." It's hard to escape the fact that after about 14 months of consideration, Amazon ended up picking two of the richest areas in the country, New York and Washington, D.C. So right off the bat, seems very suspicious. And, you know, we all have been hearing about this, you know, kind of in the background. Amazon's looking for this. And a lot of cities were very interested because, you know, as you can see, some of them are within regions which are non-coastal. You know, they're not... The heavy industry has obviously disappeared everywhere in the industrialized world. And so, you know, tech being the industry of the future, the way it is with technology in our lives today, everybody was very desperate, you know, some were extremely desperate to bring this because it will be an economic boom, right? Or so, you know, or so it was assumed
and
to be.
And so it was advertised.
As it was advertised, that's right.
So building off your point about deindustrialization, so make no mistake that this is the part where we're at, right? So deindustrialization started with the unions becoming too strong. Right, they had the sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan, and the GM plants, and that's what got the auto workers union power. Right, same thing happened all over the heavy industrialized parts of the Midwest where the good jobs were. Right, so these were high-paying jobs where a high school graduate could walk in the factory, work there until retirement. You know, have the middle-class lifestyle promised by the American dream.
Right,
now. Rather than find a way to make the economy stronger upwards and, you know, really invest in R&D, build better products, you know, have, you know, more efficient machinery and the like, and then, you know, automating people out of their jobs and instead, you know, having a universal basic income because, hey, that job that we used to ask people to do can be done by a robot. And rather than the capitalists pocketing all that money themselves, let's just, you know, pay everyone just because we don't need you anymore in the workforce. And rather than exploiting you, we can use a robot. Now, obviously, the opposite has happened. So what the capitalists have done is they've seen, you know, the writing on the wall. And the only way to make more profits was to, instead of fighting with the unions and trying to negotiate for a better deal on either end, they were just like, well, screw the unions. We're just going to move to Mexico. And that's what NAFTA was. So what NAFTA allowed these industries to do was to pick up and move. So they would have, you know, the Pfizer plant, the GM plant, just move it to Mexico where they could pay them $1 an hour versus these jobs were getting, you know, 30 or 40 bucks an hour if you had enough seniority in the union. So that is why we are where we are, is that not only was deindustrialization done not because we don't want them jobs no more, you know, it's not like these jobs are just so bad and whatever. Like, don't get me wrong, there's preventable workplace accidents all over the place, and we can get into that later.
Right.
But the reason why was merely to put more money in the pockets of these greedy people.
Right.
It has very little to do with anything else. So now we're in this place where Amazon dangling the prospect of 50,000 jobs and economic transformation, whatever that is.
Right.
I don't think it's transformation for the better.
No.
But it's a change in people's cities. And because there's so much wealth located at the top, cities need to bid and plead with Mr. Bezos to get some kind of economic prosperity because the capitalists have removed it from the cities altogether.
Right. And yeah, cities today, especially in America, stand as a juxtaposition for what capitalism is. You got at the very top, literally, physically, in the skyscrapers, the rich, and at the bottom, of course, the poor, the living poor, the homeless, everybody who's been affected.
Hey. They let servants into those upper homes, okay?
Right, my mistake.
Yeah, we're very diverse as we hire lots of black people to clean our homes.
Right, the bellhops, right. That awesome bellhop with his six-figure salary, I'm joking. right, continuing on with the article and going on with the same line of reasoning we were just saying, cities all around the country bent over backwards to try and apply, says Kalandra Cruikshank, CEO of Statebook International, a provider of economic development data. Amazon certainly got a wealth of information about what properties and incentives and attributes different communities have to offer. Critics say Amazon can use that information to make future investment decisions. So, you know, we talked about this earlier. This was an ingenious strategy. You know, I'm of the opinion that Bezos from the start was like, I'm not going to put HQ2 in Denver or Austin, Texas, or
Vancouver, Canada.
Right. Or Toronto,
Canada.
Right. Where does he go? By the way, New York, D.C. has homes in both of those places, right? D.C.
Jeff Bezos owns more than one home?
Why does he need that? Wait, why is he still working when he has over $100 billion? This guy must
be the richest man on earth.
You know, something suspicious then.
Yeah.
This guy has the most wealth in human
history. He looks like Dr. Evil.
Right.
I wish we were doing a video program just to put a picture of him as we talk about him. And then the more that you talk about the evil shit he does, the more he looks like Dr. Evil.
Right. I mean, this isn't Revenge of the Nerds. This is like Destroy Humanity.
Straight up.
Amazon has got a wealth of information and insights into cities. Cities are the future. They have been the future. They've been the present, I mean, rather. And they're how we're going to proceed, right? And
yeah, because like there used to be like a 50-50 rural-urban split.
Right.
Now you can see it's getting more and more and more.
Oh, it's like 80-20. Right?
Well, I mean, it's going to end up that way right. at least, yeah.
And that's all around the world, right? And this guy has access book. And by the way, Amazon isn't just Amazon. They have, I think, 20 subsidiary companies. So this is going to benefit all of their operations. You know,
Whole Foods?
They got the Whole Foods. Washpo is obviously news service. There's a bunch. You can just Google it, right?
Twitch,
really? Wow. Well, that's sad.
Yeah, everything. Dude, everything that's good is
everything,
on,
right?
Everything. Even this show. I mean, my boss is going to be pissed now because we're talking about him, but, you know, this is an Amazon-sponsored show.
Oh, when's Amazon going to buy UBC, I wonder? Or when are they going to buy just BC, right?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. BCA.
BCA, exactly.
British Columbia, Amazon.
Amazon, right.
I like that.
Right. And
yeah, so about the investment, thing. About right. the investment in the city. So what mm-hmm. do you think? So now they know everything about the city.
Right.
They know what's going to happen next. They know where the next university is going to be.
Yeah.
Where the next development project is going to be. Where the next highway. What do you think that's going to, why do you think they were in looking for that? And what do you think that they gain from knowing all this stuff now?
Well, it just saves them time on one end. And they can dictate pretty much the best strategy for themselves. And, you know, to tie this into our larger, of course, argument about the detrimental effects of capital, this is just another way to get everybody under their umbrella of control, right? Get people to work for them, tie people into their vast network, into these mundane, lifeless jobs of just shipping out consumer products to households across the world, right? And the thing is, they're not isolated. They're within the corporate world. They're going to sell this information to other companies. So this isn't just for Amazon's benefit. This is for virtually any other corporation. And you best believe they will sell that information. And sorry, another reason why they did this whole city contest thing was that the major cities, you know, New York being obviously the biggest of them all, will have to drive up their proposals to attract Amazon. And what they got out of them was, I believe, a $2.1 billion incentive program. By the way, when their infrastructure is just horrible for their, I think, a million commuters a day. But you know, let's give them $2 billion of tax incentive.
The richest person on earth.
Right.
The second largest company on earth needs a government handout?
Right.
Wait, are you saying that the system's rigged for the wealthy?
Right.
And it's not everyone has an equal opportunity, that the richer you get, the easier it is to move along in this world? Jeet, are you rocking my world?
I mean, if that isn't proof right there, I don't know what is. This guy has, I'm sure, $1 billion sitting around in a mattress somewhere. Maybe he does, right?
He makes the median worker salary of $30,000 every 9 seconds.
Every 9 seconds.
He makes a worker's, in the first 9 seconds of January 1st, 2018, he made the median worker salary. How nuts is that?
That's crazy.
Right? And also, I saw this was from David Sirota, a great Twitter account to follow. He said that the taxpayers of New York are going to be paying for a helipad just for, like, for Bezos. They're paying for an Amazon helipad. That's part of the incentive. What the?
How elitist is that?
Because I think that's the grift, right? Like, not now the state, which used to be the last, it was a democratic institution. Mm-hmm. You know, you go in there and you put your freaking ballot in there, and then you get freedom. You
hope
know,
people, you hope the politicians served you. Public servants, they were called.
Yeah, and now it's like they're literal private servants.
Private, yes.
It's like, what deal can I give to Amazon in the promise of these, you know, $30,000 an hour jobs? And let's talk about the jobs for a second too. Like, so we're talking about jobs that are dog shit, like the worst. They treat them like slaves.
Right.
If you go, they have a GPS tracker on you, and if you don't go to the nearest bathroom to you, say you go to a further bathroom, you'll be reprimanded.
Oh yeah.
If you they will scan you in and out with the metal, and search you for because if they think that you're stealing from them, ironically that Amazon is stealing from their workers, but that's not lost to anybody. And they then they like steal their break time. So like these are the worst kind of things. And then the cities are lining up to give it to them.
Right. It's run like a labor camp, literally. I think they actually borrowed the tactics. And yeah, there's still so many stories of employees passing out from exhaustion. Fatigue.
They park ambulances outside rather than put AC in.
Jesus.
Fuck.
they have to, you know, go to the washroom in water bottles, right? And it's just a very disgusting environment. And
and they're bending over backwards to get these jobs.
Right.
What does that say about a world where, like, where eight families, I don't know the exact families, I just heard the statistic the other day,
right,
eight families in the world mm-hmm. have as much wealth as the bottom half of people.
Right. Well, these stories are indicative billions of that people. Truth, right?
Billions. Eight families,
right.
Equal billions of people. Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, boom. That's the bottom half of America right there.
Right.
I think probably by next year it'll be just Bezos.
Oh, yeah. I think he'll buy out the other billionaires.
Yeah. Maybe just Bezos and Gates, and then Buffett will be off to the side.
Right. I mean, he likes to keep a low profile.
I would, too, if I was going to be sent to the guillotine next week. Spoiler alert.
And, you know, just one other, you know, because there's so many negative
Where do we even begin with this right. shit show?
So New York, of course, is a very large place. The specific place Amazon chose to put it, it's called Long Island City. It's located in Queens, it used to be an area with a very high historic black population. Not anymore, not the case now. It has one of the lowest levels of black home ownership. And unfortunately, gentrification is definitely going to overswarm the entire area. There's I think the largest housing project in the Western Hemisphere is actually going to be neighbors to, you know, Amazon there. And that won't be good, you know. The property tax is going to vastly increase.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's going to skyrocket. And I think that's part of the plan, though, right?
It is, right.
It's just jack up the inequality in these regions that are already horribly, horribly divided. Yeah. Like New York City, what a great example of, like, grit, poverty, racial, like, enclaves created due to, like, horrible conditions. And you're just making, you know, you're basically, this is like dumping, like, I don't know, like a oil, like a barrel of Saudi oil on the fire, you know?
Right.
It's like the worst thing you could possibly do is take this, like, massive corporation that's going to be worth $1 trillion soon.
Oh, yeah.
And just dumping it on these people. And, like, what kind of jobs are they going to get? Are they going to turn Long Island, like you said, into a labor camp?
Mm-hmm.
Is this turning into worry-free, like Boots Riley's movie, Sorry to Bother You, where
right.
everyone's, like, living inside of the warehouse? Because it's going to be... And if you think about it, though, this is probably what they're going to do. The Amazon housing solution is that we'll let you live at work and then because you can't afford the homes around you.
No, exactly. They're going to... It's going to consume every aspect of your life. And yeah, every poor person's going to be priced out. New York doesn't want poor people. Come on, let's be real. Their mayor was like, I don't know, the 20th richest person in the world. Look where we're at. The president's a billionaire.
And he's going to run in 2020. Bloomberg.
Bloomberg, right.
Yeah, he's going to run in 2020.
He knows the solutions, right? Like,
we're going to stop and frisk Amazon.
Right. We're going to ban those big gulp drinks. But, you know, forget about Monsanto. They can keep doing their thing, though.
They can keep poisoning our people.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that's what we're at. Billionaires, you know, they're celebrities, right? Why do we cherish them so much? Why?
Divine right of kings, man.
Right.
It's come back.
Mm.
The divine right of the market.
And it's not like we're hating on Bezos' success. Earlier point we tried to make, he has enough money to secure his lineage for the next 1,000 years. If the world's clearly not going to last that long, it's going to end in 12. But, like, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, and
there,
like,
are more nefarious things he is up to in that head of his.
Well, it's because it's what? In the goodwill of people? It's like, how much does it cost to end world hunger? $30 billion. He could do four of those at least. And another thing to note about Bezos is, like, his success is in setting up this organization.
Right.
The supply chain, totally vertically integrated. That's great. However, if we're going to look at the actual success, it's the workers, man.
Right.
It's those people that drop off your package. You think Bezos himself is doing anything? He's not lifting a finger. He's just a weird, bald guy who's trying to hang out with the CIA, right. buys a paper. Well, Business Insider's owned by him, too. So guess what? They write fawning articles over how great
right.
Amazon is. It's like it's like you're reading this. It's like the Spencer Latu show talking about how great the Spencer Latu show
right,
is.
Right.
It's nuts. This dystopian hell world is getting crazier by the moment.
And, you know, just to, you know, keep shining light on this story. Their other location, which we haven't given too much attention to, Arlington, Virginia, right next door to D.C.
Right next to the Pentagon.
Exactly. Their next headquarters is literally going to be beside the Pentagon. Can you see the links, people?
Like, Jeff Bezos is doing cloud software for the Pentagon. Now right. He has HQ 2. Whatever next to the Pentagon. Next to the political capital of the United States, Washington, D.C., the financial capital in New York. It seems like almost like the state and business are becoming one and the same.
It's just going to be, our state's going to be a giant conglomerate, Google's on or something like that.
Well, yeah, every area that was previously occupied by people will now be like, have corporate sponsors, you know, will be like the Telus province of British Columbia or something like that, you know, or the Kinder Morgan province when they'd finally take over. Okay, so we'll be revisiting Mr. Bezos. We'll probably be sending him to the guillotine again. He's going to probably get a few guillotines by the time the show is pulled off.
Loves the sound of his own voice.
Yeah, he's. Oh, I love getting advice from Bezos. I mean, hopefully I can apply it someday. Ajit, thank you for sending Bezos to the guillotine. The humanity thanks you. We're going to have to take a short break and for commercials, and we'll be right back.
Every day, trans folks are targeted for verbal, sexual, and violent harassment, and trans women of color and folks with disabilities are targeted even more disproportionately. The trans community is 4 times more likely than their cis peers to experience suicidal thoughts. However, this violence is often forgotten and ignored by mainstream media. The Transgender Day of Remembrance happens annually on November 20th and is an opportunity to raise awareness and mourn the loss of trans folks all over the world.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And we just finished our conversation about Amazon, and we look forward to our overlord, Jeff Bezos, running our country and the world eventually. So, Jeff, if you're listening, do not put us into your labor camp. Thank you.
You bastard.
you motherfucker. So moving on, we're going to be talking about our ex-Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who is back in the news and with a hot talk show. He was on the Ben Shapiro Show.
Two peas in a pod.
Yes, I love that.
And you know what the P stands for.
Oh, Jesus. So the headline from the National Post is, "I have no time for illegal immigration," Stephen Harper says on U.S. podcast. The subtitle, Harper, sipping from a mug branded leftist tears, saved some of his harshest criticism for progressives. This was written by Stuart Thompson, November 19th, 2018. So just from the headline, Ajit, I didn't know that progressives had that much power.
Right.
Are we really doing that much? Apparently we got Trump elected.
Well, this just shows you one aspect of the Trump effect. It gave Harper personality and some boldness, leftist tears. This guy was a joke. Yeah,
he's really taking this moment. He's like, right. I am the Trump antidote. My milquetoast conservatism and racial dog whistling will win the day.
Right.
As opposed to the brutal capitalist, neoliberal, dystopian hell world imposing Donald Trump and his bullhorn of actually just flat out racism. So I guess it's like 2 peas in a pod, actually.
Right.
3 peas in a pod. We got Ben, Trump, and Steve.
Right.
So onto the article. Former Prime Minister Stephen Harper said he has no time for illegal immigration because it turns people against legal immigration, which is a boon for the economy and potentially electorally for the Conservative Party. As I've told other leaders in other countries, no illegal immigration system or phenomenon will ever be popular with a mass of people. It just will not, said Harper in a wide-ranging conversation on the Ben Shapiro podcast on Sunday. Harper said he's fundamentally pro-immigration and that his government record in government reflects that, but that immigration has to be legal and it is not a right. I would really doubt that there's an argument to say the U.S. has no need for immigrants and that there's no immigrants who could possibly help build the U.S. economy. I think that's a nonsensical position. But what's happened in the United States, and this is what happens when you have unpopular or illegal immigration, public opinion turns against all immigration, said Harper. Ajit, my first thought when listening to this immigration debate is, wow, first of all, you are very anti-immigrant because you sound the dog whistles constantly about, you know, migrants and the like. And, you know, how do these people like completely just miss the fact that their horrible foreign policy of destabilizing the Middle East and you know, marrying up with big energy to displace people through climate change?
All right.
Really fuels this fire of migration and quote-unquote illegal immigration? Like, there wouldn't be... Well, and first of all, asylum seekers are not illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. They are refugees fleeing places that were destroyed by the U.S.
For
military.
A reason. Right.
Specifically them. It's generally them.
Right.
I haven't seen the USSR up to anything, but Rachel Maddow says otherwise. So, a recent poll by the Angus Reid Institute found that 65% of Canadians believe that the 31,000 irregular border crosses since 2017 is too many people for Canada to handle. To those people who think that's too much, we have probably the least population dense country on Earth. So I don't know how to...
Did you even notice 31,000 immigrants? Like, it was in news outlet.
Oh my God! The population of Moncton, Nova Scotia, doubled.
Right. Like,
it's yeah.
No. Most of them were white. That's why we didn't notice them. Yeah. That's why. Fleeing Trump.
Oh no. Yeah, right. Harper's comments echo the argument made in his recently released book, Right Here, Right Now: Politics and Leadership in the Age of Disruption.
Oh, that's what you call Law and Order, buddy.
Yeah, which urges conservatives to listen to populist grievances rather than focus on other priorities like tax cuts for the wealthy. Like, at least, you know, I feel like at least the National Post is self-aware enough to know that, or this National Post writer specifically, mm-hmm. Stuart Thompson, at least knows that conservatives, their whole ideology is making it easier to be rich for those who are already rich.
Right.
Because if you're cutting taxes for wealthy people, it's not going to make it easier for other people to become wealthy. It just allows wealth to sit at the top and amass, which is why we have Jeff Bezos.
Right.
Which is why we have Bill Gates, who apparently gives away all his money to Africa, yet has gotten way richer.
Right.
So nice try. Nice try, liberals. Yeah, so this is we're gonna get to his nationalism, patriotism stuff. So this is interesting, and I hope this can simulate some discussion. Harper said he sees patriotism and nationalism as virtually indistinguishable, which I think is an interesting conflation, but warned against extreme versions of it, making a both sidesism argument. He says, Steve says, I would agree that if you get far right nationalism, that's essentially racial or ethnic in character. It could become a different kind of beast, but frankly, conservatives don't advocate that kind of nationalism, said Harper. So, Ajit, what do you think about this conflation of patriotism and nationalism?
I mean, patriotism clearly borrows a lot from nationalism. It's hyperinflated nationalism, really.
Well, that's how I see it. I see it as, like, you know, patriotism, especially in the way that Harper's using it, is kind of like uncritically loving everything because it has the stamp of approval from the state.
Exactly.
Right? And the nationalism is the belief in, like, you know, the national origin stories, which are literal stories. Like, they're not, it's not actually how it happened.
No.
It's not how anything
happens. It's romanticized.
Right? And that's how I see, like, it's very interesting. And I think it's a smart thing for the conservatives to do to make them the same, that, like, never, ever questioning the powerful is patriotism and is loving your country is, like, doing everything that it says.
Yes.
So
extremely expedient.
Yeah. It's expedient to ram through horrible policies and racist garbage, which is what these people are up to. And then when he says that conservatives don't advocate that kind of nationalism, hello, have you not been paying attention to anybody? You know, like, Doug Ford is like that. Donald Trump's like that. You know, like, how can you distance yourself from these people that make your ideology possible?
Well, this is clearly the ploy of the intellectual tempered conservative that he presumes to be. And, like, you know, I'm different, right? My party doesn't
stand for
that.
I'm not like that. Yeah, I'm not that. But then what are you, Steve?
Right.
You stand for the same things. Your goals are all the same.
I mean, these guys bash liberals for just being sitting in their ivory towers fixated on theory. But all you do is theorize right here. You're not introducing any observational facts of reality into your assessment
well,
of yourself.
Well, he's not even like saying like, oh, like we don't advocate white nationalism. We rather advocate
Canadian nationalism,
which would seem, he would bring in the horrible M word, which everyone hates right now on the conservative side, which is multiculturalism,
right?
Because if he's saying I don't believe in like an ethno nationalism, then do you believe in like a multicultural nationalism?
Right,
which
right.
I'm not saying is any better. Don't get me wrong. Right. We're not nationalists here. We critically look at the structures around us, and we don't really believe that you know we're essentially Canadian.
Right.
Considering I'm not from Canada, I was born in the United States, and I'm not certainly not essentially American.
Right.
You know, I don't. Do you see yourself as essentially Canadian? That everything about you is Canadian, or is like you know a byproduct of I don't know being a half decent person.
Right.
You
exactly.
Know? Like how far does the state you know really?
Oh yeah, I mean
change your life.
Exactly. Like I think you gotta appreciate what the country gives you, but be critical at the exact same time and question it. For
well,
what, it is.
What did the country give me? Nothing. The country takes. Right?
Right.
The state is owned by the capitalist class. Like they're the ones that are taking from me right now. You know who actually gives
that was
me
my
stuff?
Immigrants' parents speaking, bro.
Yeah. Sorry. It's okay. Thank you. You got to say the right things to get in, and I'm happy that your family is here because you know when we lead the revolution, we're gonna need you right there. So
right.
Thank you. It's more like in. And at least in my opinion, it's like the people who actually built Canada were like basically slave laborers. You know, with the Chinese people building the railroad, if not like the peasant farmers that tilled the land. These are the people who really built Canada. The construction workers today, they're building all those high rises. It's not the, you know, it's not Donald Trump doing this stuff. It's not Stephen Harper. They just obfuscate that, right? They just pretend like it's them, but obviously it's physically not.
No.
It's just not true. Yeah, like sure, you gave the money for it, but you got the money from exploiting the worker. Anyways, so the circular reasoning of capitalism is apparent. So we are going to talk about China. Harper was also highly critical of Chinese trading practices and lauded U.S. President Donald Trump for being the first president willing to take on this. You have a bad deal that provides grossly unequal access, and the consequences have been the outflow of millions of jobs from the United States from Canada to China with no discernible benefits to our working population, said Harper. As a populist conservative, or frankly, I would say a conservative, you don't sign deals like that. You sign deals where you know your economy is going to benefit and that lots of people in your economy are going to benefit, he said. Harper cautioned against a trade war and protectionism in general, but said the end goal of any trade deal or trade remedy must be for China to open its markets. So there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, he completely takes on the pretends like, you know, it wasn't Brian Mulroney who signed the free trade agreement.
Right.
A literal conservative in the Conservative Party, or even that NAFTA is like a conservative wet dream that had to get pushed through by Bill Clinton, who, you know, that this is conservative politics. Right.
Right. Right. Oh, and he was never critical of it.
No, of course not. Well, because, you know, the way I see this is that he's like, oh, hindsight's 20/20. And of course, it's bad for working people. Like, you're stating the obvious. But where were you before that? Right. Because like conservative ideology is like, oh, yeah, let's open up everything, basically. You know, they pretend like they're not liberals, but like realistically, their ideology is liberal in the sense that they want markets open because that means more money for them.
Right.
Because
the producers only benefit. Right.
Exactly. The workers screwed. The capitalists cashing out, and that is basically what Harper represents. So it's just this posturing of like, oh, that's them, not us.
Right.
It's crazy to me.
And last I remember, you left office because the Canadian economy was tanking at the moment. The dollar had dropped significantly, and you know that was because there was a complete lack of diversification due to your corporate subsidies to, you know, your oil buddies in your hometown of Calgary, you know, all over Alberta, right? So it seems odd, well, not really knowing that he's a politician, but, you know, he's being highly critical of China. Now then, he was their best friend, right?
Well, the secret to China is that, you know, it keeps the markets closed because it doesn't want capital to pillage them, because that's what they do. You
right.
know, capital just sucks up all the resources. Look at America. Who's got all the money?
Right.
Is it industry? No, it's just random financiers.
Right.
Like Wall Street, do they really produce $20 million? Like, how much is Wall Street worth? Let me just look up Goldman Sachs, how much that's worth.
Right.
You know, like, so they say that
market caps, oh, north of $100 billion, no problem.
They say, okay, so their revenue is $32 billion.
Right.
They're not producing $32 billion worth of commodities. Let me just say that much.
Arbitrage. Right?
They're taking we're in the world of parasitic economics, and now, you know, Stephen Harper is trying to jump on top of this, being like, "Oh, it's everyone else's fault," even though it's the people that you support, the people you stand for, the people who fund your campaigns,
right,
specifically, and the people who are going to benefit from these things is the parasitic Wall Street people, the parasitic capitalist class, and, you know, who's left holding the bag? The workers. So,
right.
And guess what? He blames them for everything. So check this out. So, you know, we just basically explained how it's not, surprisingly, not poor people's fault for everything that's going wrong. It's actually rich people who completely screwed everything up. So Harper saved some of his harshest criticism for progressives, many of whom he said believe in the opposite of nationalism, which argues that everything their country does is wrong. Ajit, do you feel like everything your country does is wrong? Or do you feel more that when your country does something wrong, they probably shouldn't do that wrong thing? Where do you fall on the spectrum?
Right. I mean, what you assume your country is doing wrong is a subjective statement. And for workers, you know, it kind of has been doing most of you wrong, right? So that's a fair assessment from a progressive standpoint, even though, you know, we like to say workers should be progressive. Clearly, he is recognizing most workers, unfortunately, due to, you know, media brainwash and society, they're not progressive, even though they should be, right?
Yeah.
Clearly, you got to call your country out on your bullshit. Like,
you would hope.
Right. Like, we made it clear. We've made it clear from the start of the show. The state is not your servant, as, you know, we would like it to be. And by that, I mean it should be assisting you. It's not. It's doing the opposite.
No, it's distributing wealth upwards.
Upwards.
Yeah. It's
not to you.
No, it's taking money. Not only do we get wealth extracted from us at work when we make money for the private sector, right, but the public sector then takes, you know, the tax money, and through taxes and transfer, you know who wins? Rich people.
Right.
So it's like, you're getting screwed every which way.
And they don't pay their fair share.
Of course not.
That's the whole reason they're in office, is like the article mentioned earlier.
Tax cuts
for the rich, right?
For the wealthy, not
who could
you
afford it.
This one's awesome. So, before we move on, so the opposite of nationalism, I don't know why the opposite of nationalism would be like advocating for, I don't know, Ajit, peace, maybe not destroying Honduras. You know, I just really don't want my tax dollars going to support the military coup.
Or increased economic equality for your citizens who are citizens of the nation.
Yeah, that are suffering.
Like,
and that's,
isn't that the purest sense of nationalism, benefiting your fellow
everybody
countrymen?
In the like, basically everything that, you know, progressives believe in, basically justice, that, you know, we're not all like getting screwed all the time. That's, you know, that's apparently, you know, the opposite of nationalism. I digress.
Right.
So this is, we're going to end on this banger of a line. Harper also accused UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn of creating a Marxist party that was engaging in Stalinist type purges of Jewish members and people who aren't far enough left. First of all, there's no purging of Jewish members. He's not a Stalinist. What, like, you don't even know what a Stalinist is, Harper. It's just everyone that you don't like,
right,
becomes a Stalinist. A Marxist party, God, we could use one right now. But that's not politically tenable because you destroyed that, conservatives specifically, in the McCarthy era. So even using the term Marx to describe anything, even when he's right about a lot of shit,
right,
you know, is basically political suicide. So stop with that bullshit, Stephen Harper. That is so stupid.
I mean, he just going to his catalog to, oh, Marxist here, Stalinist there. Oh, I think I made my point.
He said all the scary words, Marx, Stalin, and he's saying they're
purges,
anti-Semitic.
Right, yep.
Which is funny because that was the charge levied against the USSR. That was like a Jewish conspiracy, and that like Marxism was a Jewish conspiracy, but now they hate Jews, but they're Marxists. So it's like, you know, everyone that you don't like hates Jews.
Right.
Also, on top of the hating Jews, you know who hates Jews? The conservative movement. Right. They hate them. In fact, they mowed them down in that synagogue in Pittsburgh. So
right.
I don't think that was a Stalinist that was doing that. Or maybe a Leninist? Definitely not.
Far
a Trotskyist.
Nope.
Not even a Maoist. Guess who it was?
Not an Obama voter either.
It was a MAGA chud that shot up that place. And that Stephen Harper lauds U.S. President Donald Trump, yet, you know, cannot even see the irony in talking about anti-Semitism and not even looking at himself,
right,
his own movement and all the people that he supports. So, and the people who aren't far enough left, you don't think that homes should have people in them? Oh, you can't be in Jeremy Corbyn's party. Like, what a crazy thing.
Right.
Like, that's it.
Jeremy Corbyn's become this stick man for the political right. Like, they just love bashing him continuously. successfully, even though what he stands for, you know, Britain is just, you know, like a mecca of economic inequality. That's not very much of a mecca, but, you know, at least he's trying to correct something out there.
And that's what they hate the most, is someone trying to make people's lives better.
Right.
Thank you for that, Ajit. I think that's a really good spot to end on. So thank you for listening this evening. We hope that you keep all those trans people that lost their lives this year in your thoughts, and understand that that is due to the inherent and violently enforced heteronormativity of our society. If you want to hear more of the Spencer Latu Show, check us out on Apple Podcasts and on iTunes. We'll be back next Tuesday at 10 p.m. to talk some more communist propaganda with you all. So until then, we'll see you next week.
All right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. Hey. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France, Montreal. What the f***?
It's the script.
I couldn't even. What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, okay, just back from France.